On this page are 5 points of introduction to the origins of Christian monasticism. We've already seen something of the literature of early Christian asceticism in the form of a portion of the life of Saint Anthony. But we're going to concentrate here in particular on the remote origins of asceticism and then the development of the desert communities in Egypt, which gave rise to the tradition of the sayings, the apophthegmata, and the lives of the desert fathers and mothers, which played such an important role in the development of the Christian notion of spiritual guidance and direction. In particular, this will provide an introduction for us to a literature which will lead us into the writings of one of the desert fathers in particular, Evagrius Ponticus, whom we will consider in some detail, as well as his disciple, John Cassian. Let's look at the first bar, the first label, spiritual guidance, and the suggestion is made here that what we will find in Christian asceticism, in the development of the monastic tradition, is the bringing together of at least 2 models of spiritual guidance, which we've already looked at. The one being what we saw in the lives of the martyrs, individuals whose powers of vision and of intercession were particularly prized in the early church. It is often said, and it has been said throughout Christian literature, that the early monks and nuns were in some sense the successors of the martyrs. And this has often been misunderstood to mean that their extreme asceticism was a kind of martyrdom. That's not primarily what this insight meant. What it refers to is that the charism that was particularly associated with the martyrs became, in some sense, the inheritance, was transferred, as it's suggested here, to the desert fathers and mothers, who likewise became figures whose powers of vision and intercession were highly regarded, and who, even more than the martyrs, were sought out for particular forms of advice. As we'll see, the tradition of going to a desert father or mother and asking for a word, a bit of spiritual counsel or advice, either in regard to a particular problem or just in general with regard to one's life, really form part of the basis of this great wisdom literature collection, which we call the apophthegmata or the sayings. As we'll see, the other tradition that comes to bear is not just the tradition of the martyrs who were seers and intercessors, but also the notion of the scriptures as a model of spiritual guidance and direction. Many of these desert fathers and mothers, and I mentioned in particular in this text, Evagrius Ponticus, whom we'll study in more detail, and Melania, who was Evagrius' spiritual mother, were renowned as spiritual exegetes, as masters of the scriptures, for whom the Bible was the principal source book of spiritual guidance and direction. If we drop down to number 2, early Christian celibate communities, the point is made here, and we've noticed it in passing before, that although we think of or speak of, and if you look at the timeline below the text, we think of Antony the Great, who lives from around 251 to around 356, living to be more than 100 years old, although he's referred to as the father of monasticism, in fact, what he really contributes is that he carries the monastic tradition into the desert, into the forsaken place. There were already, as we've seen, ascetics living around the villages in Antony's youth, and indeed the tradition of women's monastic communities, communities originally of widows and then widows and virgins, existed probably from apostolic times, although their early history is virtually unknown. There's a reference here to Peter Brown's great book, The Body and Society, which I heartily recommend, in pages 147 to 149. He describes something of these early Christian women's communities. And again, we know very little about them, but we do know that they existed. Thus, we have to be able to say that Antony really isn't the founder in any sense of monasticism, but he becomes the popular icon. He becomes the one who, through his biography, is regarded as the model of ascetics. And through the popularization of this great biography, his model, and as we'll see, the great homily that he preaches, become models of discernment as well. It's also well worth mentioning that the Syrian church, already in the 200s, in the 3rd century, certainly had celibate liturgical and social service communities of men and women, which were called the Sons and Daughters of the Covenant. We know this from the writings of Aphrates and a number of others, their communities did not give rise to the Christian monastic tradition of Egypt. It represents a separate strand, but there may have been some interaction between the two a bit later on. The difficulty with the Syrian church is that it was heavily infected with encratism, a tendency to extol celibacy over marriage, which was eventually condemned as a heresy, although the Syrian church, to some extent, at least in these communities, didn't carry it to quite that extreme. So all of this existed before the time of the great monastic foundations that we'll see. They were the kind of waiting matrix out of which monasticism came into existence. And this timeline, which we've glanced at before, shows us Antony the Great, and then Saint Pachomius below him, who is the founder of the cenobitic communities, that is to say, the individuals who live not in isolated hermitages or in very small groups clustered around a single father or mother, but larger communities really modeled on the Roman army, rather huge monastic settlements, more in the middle and south of Egypt, and leaving behind a monastic rule which Saint Jerome would translate into Latin and which would become influential. The timeline also shows the relative relationship in terms of time between these great founders, Antony and Pachomius, and then Evagrius, the great synthesizer of monastic doctrine and mystical theology, and his pupil John Cassian, who transmits this teaching to the West by literally translating it into Latin. And then the three great Cappadocian fathers, influenced by monasticism and contributing especially to the developing life of the institutional church through their theology of the Trinity and their theology of the divinity of Christ. So all of these things are deeply intertwined, and of course the interaction between monastic theology and ecclesiology, coming more from bishops, heavily influences the other sources that we'll be considering in this course, in particular Democopolis's book. If we look now at section 3, Monks and Nuns of the Egyptian Desert, the map on the left and the description on the right will help locate the three vitally important communities of Nitria, Kelia, and Skete or Sketus. They're near the city of Alexandria, to the south of Alexandria, and located near the Nile Delta. As we'll see, Nitria and Kelia were close enough to be able to take advantage of a sort of an offshoot of a tributary that came from the Nile and then passed on towards Alexandria, which meant that these communities were well supplied with goods as they needed them. These two communities in particular, Nitria and Sketus, but Kelia as well, which was more of a hermit community, are really the source of the majority of the sayings and lives of the desert fathers and mothers, the traditions of the Apothegmata, both in the Greek and in the Latin versions, which we possess. There's a description of them, Antony's monastery, his original monastery near the Nile, and then his remote monastery near the Red Sea. That second site near the Red Sea became and is still a very important pilgrimage spot for the Egyptian church today, for Egyptian Christians, as well as the community of Sketus or Skete. That's a very important ecclesial center, as we'll see at the bottom of this page. Then in the south of Egypt, in the Thebaid, the communities of Kinobaskion, of Phob, and Tabanesis are the principal foundations of Pachomius, who created this much more community-oriented, large community-oriented context of monasticism, different from the communities of Nitria and Sketus, where there were smaller groupings of individuals around spiritual fathers and mothers, and the community of Kelia, which was primarily a hermit's community. If we drop down to the next little box, there is a description of the fact that the community, the ancient monastic site of Nitria, which was founded by Amun in 330, no longer exists in terms of archaeology. The inundations, that is to say, the turning over of the land to agriculture, has had the effect that the original buildings, which were generally made of mud brick, have turned back into mud. They've more or less disappeared, and so there's practically nothing at all left of the site of Nitria. Although, as we'll see, Kelia was excavated, especially in the 60s, and photographed, but unfortunately it too has become inundated and very little of it remains, although we do have photographic records of those archaeological studies, and some of them are on this page. If you drop down, this describes the community of Kelia, otherwise known as the Cells, which was a kind of daughter community from Nitria. Nitria having been founded by this legendary founder Amun in 330, Kelia was created for the purpose of offering an opportunity to those who wished to live a somewhat more remote life. If you drop down to the two maps, the one that is a photograph, a satellite photograph, that gives you an idea in green of the area which has now been turned over to agriculture, and you can see how, if you compare it with the same scale map on the left, you can see how it really is pushing out what remained of the area of Kelia, and which was excavated, as I mentioned, in the 1960s, but you can see a kind of a little blue crescent, which is the area of Sketis, called the Wadi Natrun, including the monasteries of Baramus, the monastery of the Syrians, Peshoi, and St. Macarius. That area is still vitally important for the Coptic, the Egyptian church today. I mention in the next section that Kelia, this hermit community, was founded as a daughter from Nitria. And the story of its foundation is given in the text that you see in number 34, taken from the Sayings of the Desert Fathers, and this is the only description we have of it. The legend goes that Abba Amun was visited by Antony the Great, and question was asked, what do we do about these brothers who want to have more quiet, more hezukia, more peace? And Antony says, let us have a meal, and then let's go for a walk in the desert. So ostensibly they explored the desert and walked, and then stopped at an area which would, according to them, allow individuals to be close enough to the community of Nitria to be able to take advantage of the fact that it was accessible from the Nile and therefore could bring in supplies, and yet have a greater degree of distance, a greater opportunity for hermit life, and it's about 12 miles from that now no longer extant site of Nitria. But the site of Kelia, as I mentioned, was possible to discover because it remained a very important monastic center through approximately the 7th and into the 8th centuries. And there's a map, which is part of an archaeological map, that shows the 7-mile-wide settlement of Kelia. And each of the dots, each of the little black dots, and you can see clusterings of them in areas that are listed under their Arabic names, each of those dots is an individual cell. And there are huge numbers of them. There are approximately 1,500 separate cells or little monastic enclosures or dwellings, and that's approximately the size that they had by the 600s. If you drop down a little further, there's a square, the Qasr al-Izalia. That is an area that was excavated in some detail, and of which there are a number of both photographic and text records. And if you enlarge that square, you can see that in the next picture down, there's a kind of a schematic drawing of the 130 cells and churches that were present there, and an example of sort of a schematic, a 3D drawing of one of these is a little further down on the page, one of the rather typical 6th century hermitages at Kelia, in which you had a building on the left, which would house the spiritual elder, the Abba, and probably one or two of his disciples. There was room also for a well in the little courtyard, a storage area kind of in the far right, and this would be a place where the spiritual Abba could receive guests. The wall became necessary as some sort of defense was required as incursions by Bedouins became more common, especially in the 400s and later. And the photograph on the right gives you some idea of the roughness of the terrain, not in Kelia itself, but in Sketis, which is a few miles to the south. So further down, you see a very primitive excavation showing the most simple form, which was basically a one or two room trench covered with a roof, and this would supply the location in which a monk could dwell. all of these had a little niche, a little niche in the wall with a cross in it, which was located on the east side, and it evidently provided a focus for prayer when it wasn't possible to pray outside because of the excessive heat. If you drop down a little further, there are examples of the ornamental style of these crosses that were photographed when the photographic emergency excavation of Kelia was performed. It was an emergency because everyone knew that the Egyptian government was going to turn the area into agriculture. Sadly, the Egyptian government, which is much more interested in pharaonic antiquity, did not permit this material to be removed, so it was photographed in situ and is now gone, the overwhelming majority of it. The presence of agriculture basically meant that all of this material, composed primarily of sculpted mud and carved sandstone, has been reduced to sludge. However, again, we have the photographic records that give us some idea of what they looked like. If we drop then down to number 6, to Skeet or Sketis, this is the area currently known as the Wadi Natroon, for the natron or salt deposits that were found there in antiquity and were actually still being mined up until several decades ago. This area was occupied in the 4th century, was a very important monastic center, as significant in its own way, although a bit more remote, than Nitria. And Nitria and Sketis provide a very, very large number of the sites in which the sayings of the Desert Fathers and Mothers took place, primarily the Desert Fathers in this case. The women tended to be often in sites that were a bit safer and more in closer locations to the cities, or in the case of the Pacomians, near the Pacomians' very large monasteries. And these sites have been more or less continuously occupied since antiquity. And those monasteries that are listed, Baramis, the Monastery of the Syrians, Peshoy, and the Monastery of St. Macarius, they all still exist. They are all still very flourishing monasteries. And indeed, they alternate as the seats of the Patriarch of Alexandria. Since in the Orthodox and in the Coptic traditions, and by the way, the Coptic Church is not in communion with Constantinople. It's in communion with the Armenian Church and the churches of the East, but not with the Orthodox churches or with Rome. These churches, like other Eastern and the Orthodox churches, permit deacons and priests to marry, but bishops must remain celibate. So it is extremely common for bishops to be recruited from the ranks of the monks, and the monasteries therefore play a very important role, as I mentioned in the discussion of St. Anthony. The monasteries play a very important role in parish life in the Coptic and in many of the Eastern Church traditions. And finally, at the bottom of the page is a rather complex chart, originally in German, and some of the names are still in German, I'm afraid, which shows the interrelationship between the most common and most important desert fathers and showing who was taught by whom. If you look kind of in the upper left, at the highest level is Antony, Antonius, Amun, and Hilarion, all of whom knew one another. And Antony, as you can see, is more or less the spiritual father of Chronios, Pterion, Joseph of Panephesus, Ammonas, Peor, Pambo, and then in a kind of an extended way of Saint Theodore of Tabanesis. But Pambo is a very important second generation figure. He is known to and is the spiritual father of Macarius, of Egypt. There are two great Macarii, and without going into detail, these are people who were also known to and were important influences on Evagrius, whom we'll be looking at in some more detail. So this just shows the degree of interconnection and the generational succession of these important teachers. And as we read or hear their names, it's possible to go back and just get a sense of how they were connected with one another.